Nepal is a small country on the northeast border of India, separating India and China. The Sherpas and the Gurkhas are two Nepalese groups who are both known for their special skills. The Sherpas are well known for their mountain climbing skills. The Gurkhas are well known for their courage, for their skill in warfare. In his book called One Crowded Hour, the book is about cameraman Neil David. The author, Tim Bowden, tells of an incident that happened in Borneo during the confrontation between Malaysia and Indonesia in 1964. A group of Gurkhas from Nepal were asked if they'd be willing to jump from transport planes into combat against the Indonesians if the need arose. The Gurkhas had the right to turn down the request because they'd never been trained as paratroopers. Bowden quotes David's account of the story like this. He said, "Now the Gurkhas usually agreed to anything, but on this occasion they provisionally rejected the plan. But the next day one of their NCOs sought out the British officer who had made the request and said they had discussed the matter further and would be prepared to jump under certain conditions. The British officer asked what the conditions were. The Gurkhas told him they would jump if the land was marshy or reasonably soft with no rocky outcrops because they were inexperienced in falling. British officer considered this and said that the dropping area would almost certainly be over jungle. There would be no rough, rocky outcrops, so all that seemed okay. Was there anything else? Man said, yes, they wanted the plane to fly as slowly as possible and no more than 100 feet above the ground. British officer pointed out that planes always did fly slowly as possible when dropping troops, but to jump from 100 feet was impossible. He said the parachutes would not have time to open from that height. Well, this shocked the Gurkhas. They said, oh, that's all right then. We'll jump anywhere with parachutes. We didn't know you were offering parachutes. Now that's commitment. Slow down and give us 100 feet and we'll jump. The Apostle Paul had commitment like that. When Paul was bound in prison on false charges, he pointed out that his imprisonment had turned out for good because he was able to further the gospel even in his chains. And he rejoiced because whether he lived or died, Christ would be magnified. Philippians 1, verses 12 through 24. I'm going to read that. A portion of that was already read. But I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel, so that it has become evident to the whole palace guard and to all the rest that my chains are in Christ. And most of the brethren in the Lord, having become confident by my chains, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ even from envy and strife, and some also from goodwill. The former preach Christ from selfish ambition, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my chains, but the latter out of love, knowing that I am appointed for the defense of the gospel. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached, and in this I rejoice, yes, and will rejoice. For I know that this will turn out for my salvation through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but that with all boldness, as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I live on in the flesh, this will mean fruit from my labor, yet what I shall choose I cannot tell. For I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy of faith, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again. What is it that enabled Paul to make such statements as we just read? The answer to that, of course, is found in verse 21. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. There are two points in this text that I believe will help us understand how Paul could make such a statement. We're going to focus on those, and then we're going to give some attention to the statement itself, the statement found in verse 21. First of all, we ask the question regarding the statement that we just read in verse 20. Christ would be magnified by Paul. He says in verses 19 and 20, I know this will turn out for my salvation through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but that with all boldness as always, so now also Christ will be magnified in my body, whether by life or by death. Other translations render it highly honored. He'll be highly honored in me or in my body, or exalted in my body. How could Paul possibly magnify Christ? Christ is obviously bigger, more important, superior than Paul. How could he be magnified by Paul? How could the lesser magnify the greater? Well, consider a telescope. Stars are obviously much bigger than the telescope, but the telescope magnifies them and brings them closer, enlarges them. By looking at Paul, by looking at his life, by looking at his body, the things that he did in his body, one could see Christ more clearly. In a similar way, the Christian's life is to be a telescope, if you will, that brings Christ into view for unbelievers. To the average person, Christ is just a misty figure in history who lived centuries ago, but when unbelievers watch a Christian go through a crisis, or when they just observe them living daily as salt and light, they should be able to see Christ magnified. They should be able to see Christ enlarged and brought closer to them. There's a song that we sing sometimes in our hymn book. It's song number 788. I'd like to read that as it emphasizes this point. It's called The World's Bible. Christ has no hands but our hands to do his work today. He has no feet but our feet to lead men in his way. He has no tongue but our tongues to tell men how he died. He has no help but our help to bring them to his side. We are the only Bible the careless world will read. We are the sinner's gospel. We are the scoffer's creed. We are the Lord's last message, given in deed and word. What if the type is crooked? What if the print is blurred? What if our hands are busy with other things than his? What if our feet are walking where sin's allurement is? What if our tongues are speaking of things his life would spurn? How can we hope to help him and welcome his return? To the unbeliever, Jesus Christ is pretty small, carries little weight in their lives. He's quite insignificant, if you will. But as an unbeliever watches a Christian go through a crisis, he should be able to see Christ enlarged. Should be able to see the Christian behave in such a way, the Christian's body, the Christian's life is a lens. It draws Christ closer so that people can see Christ lived out in that person's life. Paul Elliott playwright and novelist nobly put it this way. He said, "My body will be the theater in which Christ's glory is displayed." Once we put Christ on by our life and our conduct, we either bring glory to him or we bring shame to him. A leader is judged by his followers. And Christ, if you will, is often judged by us. Paul mentions his desire to depart in verses 23 through 26. I'll read those again. If I live on in the flesh, I'm sorry, that's verse 22. Verse 23, "For I am hard pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you. And being confident of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy of faith, that your rejoicing for me may be more abundant in Jesus Christ by my coming to you again." Though Paul had his own desires, he wanted to do what was best for others. He indicates that he would gladly postpone heaven for their benefit. Of course, one thing worthy of our attention here is his confidence of heaven. Paul had absolutely no question about where he would spend eternity. For Paul, death held no terrors. It simply meant departing. The word depart carried four basic meanings. When it was used in a military sense, it meant to take down your tent and move on. Paul refers to our body as a tent in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 1, and then I'll read verse 6 through 8 as well. He says, "We know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands." Verse 6 now, "Therefore we are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in this tent," he says, "this body, we are away from the Lord, for we live by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body or this tent and be at home with the Lord." So he's not talking about just taking down the tent, just getting rid of the body, but he's talking about moving on. Taking down the tent is not the end. There's more after that. Departing is not the end. In World War II, the pilots of the British Royal Air Force were never spoken of as having been killed, but always as having been posted to another station. When the word depart was used as a sailing term, it meant to loosen a ship and set sail. Lord Alfred Tennyson used this figure of death in his famous poem, "Crossing the Bar," a reference to the sandbar, and referring to death. He says, "Sunset and evening star, and one clear call for me, and may there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea." That's the loosening of a ship and setting sail. The last two lines of the poem go on to say, "I hope to see my pilot face to face," an obvious reference to Christ, "when I have crossed the bar." Again, in this usage, to loosen a ship and set sail, there's no indication of the end of a journey. In fact, it's just the opposite. It's the beginning of the journey. The word depart was also a political term. It described the setting free of a prisoner. Christians have been freed from sin by obedience to the gospel, Paul says in Romans chapter 6. Christ spoke of the truth setting you free in John chapter 8 and verse 32. As Paul is using it here, death is not the prison. Our body is the prison. The Christian is finally set free when his spirit leaves this body. Finally, departure was a word used by farmers. It meant to unyoke the oxen Paul is desiring to be with Christ where he'll be able to finally lay his yoke aside, no more burdens to bear. In Shakespeare's Hamlet, Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark, delivered a soliloquy in which he viewed both the present life and the after-death state as equally undesirable and terrifying. To live or to die, one's as bad as the other. When considering the evils of life, he could incline toward death, except in his reasoning for the thought that evil dreams would torture him there. And so Hamlet stands as the typical unregenerated man, the typical unbeliever, oppressed by life, but afraid to die. When Paul's life or death would give such glory to Christ, when Paul's life or death would show the power and the glory of Christ, would magnify him, and when Paul's attitude toward death was according to what we just discussed, it's no wonder Paul could say, "For me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain." And that expresses a clear singleness of mind. To live is Christ, to die is gain. Nothing can steal a man's joy if he is totally committed to Christ. When Paul was in prison, he was glad for the opportunity to teach and to be an example. Verses 12 and 13 of our text. When Paul was in prison, he was glad that this gave other Christians the boldness to speak out. Verse 14, he was glad that whether he lived or died, Christ would be magnified by either. He was glad to depart. For others' sake, he was glad to remain. How can you threaten somebody like that? What can you do to such an individual? Would you like to be like that? How can we become like that? The simple answer is found there in verse 21. For to me, to live is Christ. Someone has said, life is what we are alive to. He said, when my wife and I go shopping, I dread going to the housewares department. However, if we're on our way to the housewares section and I spot the book department, I suddenly become alive. The thing that really excites us, that really gets us going, that thing is life to us. In Paul's case, Christ was life. Christ is what excited him. Christ is what made his life worth living. Philippians 1:21 becomes a valuable test of our lives. Fill in the blanks. For to me, to blank, to live, I'm sorry, is blank, and to die is blank. Fill in the blanks. For to me, to live is fame, and to die is to be forgotten. For to me, to live is money, and to die is to leave it all behind. For to me, to live is power, and to die is to lose it all. Or perhaps less ambitious things. For me, to live is relaxation. For me, to live is vacation. For me to live is retirement. For me to live is movies or gratification of fleshly desires or food or the accumulation of things, fun. What are the things we really enjoy talking about? What are the things we really love to do with our spare time? What do we choose to spend our money on? These things show our priorities and they tell what really excites us, what brings us to life. Philippians was written during Paul's imprisonment in Rome because of his singleness of mind. He could look at his circumstances, his imprisonment, the fact that he would be chained, was chained to a Roman guard 24 hours a day, with a shift change every 6 hours. His opportunity to speak to Christ, speak of Christ to the officials of Caesar's court. He was grateful for all these things because of his singleness of mind. Paul could look at these things as God-given opportunities for the furtherance of the gospel. He was able to rejoice at what God is going to do instead of complaining about what God did not do, that is, prevent these circumstances from occurring. If we would know the joy that Paul knew, in spite of being mistreated by others, in spite of being falsely accused, in spite of being in bad circumstances, then we must echo Paul's conviction of having Christ first in our lives. If we would truly know the peace, the joy, the contentment that Paul knew, which enabled him to sing in prison, to rejoice in his chains, to be happy with life or death, we must learn to say what Paul said here in Philippians 1:21, and a variation which he spoke in Galatians 2:20, when he said, "I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me." Let's stand together and sing.